amazing. He's just throwing jelly tarts at their eyeballs. What if he misses and it goes into their mouth?
And they're doing, delicious battle.
And welcome everyone to the Vassals of Kingsgrave Dragon Prince edition. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the Dragon Prince Season 3, the show that comes from Netflix and Wonderstorm and is like Game of Thrones, but with wholesome messages and also low-key better. I'm Michal. I go by Ink as Rain on the podcast Vice and Power Forms, and I'm joined by Bina.
Hey everyone, this has been a 007, pointing out that as wonderful as this is, it's still a kids' show and it's not better than Game of Thrones. Now we may proceed.
Whoa. I thought nothing was as bad as Game of Thrones.
I'm talking about the books.
Oh, okay. Oh yeah, yes.
That's fine then.
Yeah. I'm joined also by Zach.
Hi, this is Alias in the Forms.
And Adam.
Hey, it's Adam Drownsnow on the Forms.
Yeah, so let's start off, I guess, with our ratings for season 3. What should we rate? I feel like there's nothing other than like jelly tarts that like really stands out.
We always use jelly tarts.
Yeah, okay. Let's go with jelly tarts.
It is the way.
It is. Adam, across the streams a little bit. Adam, what's your jelly tart rating?
I give this a 4 out of 5. I really enjoyed it. I thought the last bit was somewhat abrupt, and then, you know, it cuts off into the next season, which they sort of did last season, but the battle and everything, I felt like, you know, that everything went kind of quick once Viren took over. But other than that, I really liked it.
Awesome. And Zach, how about you?
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. I think besides Bait, Soren was my favorite character of this season by far. I loved his arc, and I also enjoyed a lot of the stuff they did with Rayla this season. However, I do think this season once again suffered from its short 9-episode format. There were storylines that were so rushed that they were ultimately kind of undercut or unsatisfying at the end, and some character decisions that just didn't make sense to me. But I still enjoyed watching it, and I think it's gotten a lot better visually as well, so I like that. So I'll give it like a, I guess, 3.5 jelly tarts.
And how about you, Bina?
I really enjoyed it, and I thought it built to a really satisfying climax. And honestly, I don't know what I would change. I think you're right that, Zach, that it could have done with a bit more time. Maybe 4.5. I mean, super high. There's nothing I didn't like about it. And I rewatched the last 3 last night and was as into them. So yeah, really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so I think I would probably give it probably a 4, possibly a 4.5 after I rewatched it. I have some issues with like the middle of the season and the like some things where I think they could have just like made things a little stronger. But overall, I think the themes of the season are really powerful, and overall, I'm pretty satisfied with the way things went. I did really want more Claudia, though, I will admit.
Me too.
Okay, so I guess let's talk about characters, speaking of Claudia. But we don't have to speak about Claudia first, because she's pretty, she's like barely in the season, to be honest. Let's talk about like the dragon trio first. So Callum, Ezra, and Callum, Rayla, and Baby Zim, who is the best character in the whole show.
In light of The Mandalorian, do you really feel Baby Zim is the cutest baby on TV right now?
Obviously.
You know, I was like fully like willing to switch over my allegiance to Baby Yoda, but then I just rewatched, you know, the Dragon Prince season 3, and like, he is so freaking cute. Like, especially like in that last scene with Viren, when he's like, you know, trying to fly away and he's like using his little lightning powers and he's squeaking Pastora. Like, he is just really, really cute. And I'm not gonna pit 2 sweet, adorable, wonderful, wholesome babies against each other, but I think there's less potential for error in interpretation when we're talking about like toys and stuff when it comes to Zim than it comes to Baby Yoda, because some of those are just creepy.
Yeah, because Baby Yoda is like holding a cup staring at you in disappointment right now.
Yeah, big events happened for Callum and Rayla. They finally stopped the dance and got together, and Callum learned how to fly. That's a
I thing. Think that's all he did, though. Love. What else did Callum do this season? Not much.
Yeah.
I'll say that Elf Callum is my spirit animal. Let me say that.
I actually did think of you, Adam, when he was doing that stuff. Sounded like about your accent.
How dare you?
Yeah, that was really funny. I enjoyed that a lot. I mean, you kind of knew it was coming, but like, it doesn't matter. It was still great. I thought the episode, it actually might be one of my favorite episodes, where they go to Rayla's home and she's been ghosted basically by her community, and they meet Renan's husband. I thought that was really like a very powerful moment on its own, but also for the two of them, because it is this like, you know, complete unmooring of everything that Rayla has expected. And she is not my favorite character by any means, but I felt like it was a very powerful experience to watch her go through.
It's also something that is surprisingly relevant, right? This idea of being ghosted, or you could say being canceled by your society, yeah. I think is what we see with Rayla, which it was a surprisingly effective way to represent that in a kid's show.
Yeah.
And because like they did it with limited information, and even when they sort of got an explanation, didn't undo it.
Mm. It was a beautiful metaphor. And I felt, if you think of the age range of some of the kids watching this, you know, running around the school playground when people, like, I don't know if you have this in England, we call it sending someone to Newcastle, and I don't know why.
We don't have that in the US.
When you just decide not to talk to them over lunchtime because you're just being mean. And I just thought this was a really interesting way to show kids, like, what that could feel like, or metaphorically, as well as us in our cancel culture.
And I don't know if you guys know this, but kids, and this is what my little brother and sister told me, kids actually do call it canceling people now when it's the thing in high school. You just like ostracize someone.
Oh no,
it's what they call it now. So it is actually a thing that kids do. Gosh. So yeah,
that makes me so very sad.
Is it like is it the type of thing where it's like they'll just randomly give someone silent treatment and like you're canceled, or is it like
I think this has always happened in school, right, where just someone like gets kicked out of the club, you know, or gets kicked out of the friend group. It's that kind of thing.
Very glad I'm not in high school anymore.
Oh, me too.
Any thoughts on Callum and Rayla getting together?
Inevitable. I mean, sweetly done, but yeah.
Well, not according to the fandom. It wasn't inevitable. There's lots of options. Well, I mean, we thought Claudia was an option with Callum, right? At one point.
Look, the thruple is still in play.
Yeah, I don't think Rayla would have anything to do with that.
I'm curious where they go with this from here, because the typical thing with this, right, is at some point it's going to go badly, right? I'm curious if they're going to do that, or if it's just going to be like a supportive relationship the whole way, if we do get more content, which I guess is an open question.
Well, especially if he turns out to be morally questionable, the creator.
Right. Yeah. Mm. And Callum, maybe. He might do something wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah. He's kind of been through his... that's the thing with Callum. I feel like he's been through his challenge, like his battle with himself, with all the dark magic stuff in season two, which is kind of why he felt to me like a supporting character in this season, where he is very much supporting Rayla's own kind of battle with her demons in this season and the things that she's dealt with in her past. So I was fine with that, but there wasn't like a lot of change or nuance to his choices in this one.
And that's okay, right? Not every character is going to have a full development arc in every season, especially when it's only 9 30-minute episodes.
Indeed.
Yeah, hopefully they just sort of avoid all that. I know, like, the common trope, and one I hate, is, like, if a coupling gets together in a series, it's like, well, we have to find a way to create conflict and separate them or whatever, because that's the only way to be interesting. But with it being a kid's show, maybe, you know, they're just like, let's not bother. Things.
They already, like, they did that a little bit at the very end where, like, you know, Rayla says that she has to, like, stay and die for Zim and the Dragon Queen, and Callum, like, freaks out about that, and then she's like, oh, well, you never understood me at all, and then they, like, resolve that within a couple of minutes.
So, yeah.
I feel like situationally they might get divided, like, just, like, I have to go here, you have to go there, maybe more than, like, actual relationship drama. I don't see Claudia as a threat to their relationship anymore. I think she and Callum are on very different paths, and yeah.
Maybe if she brings some pancakes.
So yeah, let's talk about Ezrin next. It was funny because I was reading, or I was like listening to some podcasts about Henry VI, and I was, like, getting some, like, Henry VI vibes in Ezrin, in terms of, like battling for peace without, like,
wait, possibly... is Henry VI the shit one, the one who lost everything his dad won in France? Like, Henry V wins everything, and then Henry VI loses it all. Is that
yeah, exactly.
That's the Henry, okay.
Yeah, but he was apparently trying to, you know, assert peace in a situation that was not equipped to, you know, have peace asserted in it, at least according to the podcast I listened to. I can
in other words,
to, you know?
Any situation with France. Yes, I agree.
Right, yeah. So this historian's argument is basically that he, you know, he did have genuinely good intentions, but he wasn't strong enough to follow through on them, and the mechanisms weren't there for it to, like, work. And I kept thinking about that when, like, Ezrin was like, it doesn't matter, we're just going to make peace. And I was like, I'm totally with you, but I think this could also go really, really badly, as it almost does. So I found that really powerful, personally.
Hmm.
So for me, this was my least favorite part of the season, and this is the main character issue I had in the season. And I mean, there's good stuff with it, like, obviously, like, the guards and stuff are really fun, and, like, the stuff with the just being king for a little bit, that, like, some of that stuff is fun. But for me, like, I just, the stuff with Ezrin just didn't make any sense to me. So I understand, like, I understand that they're kind of setting him up to fail here. Like, he's just not the type of person that's equipped to be a king in this environment, and they're doing their mini Game of Thrones intrigue thing where all the people obviously are not going to tolerate his form of rule, so they're going to conspire against him to remove him from power. All that's fine, and I'm totally cool with Ezrin sticking to his principles and not being the kind of king that they want him to be and all that stuff, and just frankly not being a very good king, because why should he be a good king, right? He's just like 8 or whatever, so I wouldn't expect him to have the sort of political maneuvering required to be successful here. So that's all fine. It was a little rushed. It was kind of strange they just forgot about him and moved on after he escaped, but that's fine. But for me, like, when you get to the end of the season and he immediately joins the battle with dragons and starts burning people, I get they're monsters, okay? I get they've been transformed at this point, but it just feels like a total undercut of everything that was going on with him up to that point. And this show, for me, like, so much about it, especially last season, was about the cost of life and the choices you have to make to try to preserve life. And, like, just all of that went away. Like, that was just gone at the end. I don't know. It just felt like Ezrin, like, everything about his character was kind of ignored at the end, and I was just left very confused by that.
Yeah, I hear that. I mean, for me, actually, the biggest problem in Ezrin's arc was the part where he, like, agrees to abdicate, and then, like, and then everybody just forgets about him, and they have the magic phoenix that flies him back, you know. I was just kind of like, this feels, yeah, it feels too much like a deliberate reversal of, like, the powerful choice that he made last season, especially because it happened so quickly.
Exactly. It's just, none of this felt
because they were like, we need Viren with an army, so let's just forget about this whole thing.
Yeah, it felt like a, I don't know, like, just like, let's do this for fun for a couple episodes. Like, it didn't feel like it had weight to it, any of this choice. It just felt like it was a distraction.
And, like, but, like, I really liked seeing him deal with that, and I liked, like, the imagery of him, like, looking at the crown and his, like, speech at the end about how Harrow was, like, a great father and an imperfect king, and I thought that was really canny and powerful from the show, especially given the flashbacks that we see. But I actually hadn't thought about that exactly. I think that's a good point about, like, the lack of, you know, negotiation, I guess, with Viren's forces. Although I guess you could say that they're, like, actively attacking, as opposed to, like, you know, currently the situation he's in at the beginning is like, we can continue these the violence, or we cannot continue the violence. Whereas Viren's just like, hey, knock knock, violence.
Would it have been different if they had not been transformed into monsters? Like, how would the image have looked if Ezrin just roasting all these citizens of his, you know, soldiers, but citizens of his kingdom?
Well, I actually thought of you, Bina, when the dragons come and start burning shit, because I was like, this is why Bina hates dragons.
It goes without saying.
I personally really like seeing dragons fight on the side of good. Like, I enjoyed that a lot personally, because I'm a dragon person. No, I think it's a good point, and I think that was probably a choice from on their part, that, like, these people are I mean, you sort of see at the end, like, some of the monster people are being apprehended, like, they're actually being arrested, but obviously, it's not just that they're not human, so it's okay to kill them, they're also, like, they're not being killed by the fire, so it's kind of, like, a different situation.
I guess.
And but thinking about that, that probably was part of their calculus in writing it that way. I think that was probably, yeah.
It feels like an easy out to me.
I hear that.
And I get it's a kid's show, but I think you can be smarter about this stuff. And the reason it frustrates me is because it felt like a really important theme of the show. Like, the choices to be made about whether or not you're going to engage in war and engage in violence. Like, that felt like a really important thing in the past couple seasons. So, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It felt like it undercut that stuff to have a cool battle.
Yeah, I wonder if it would have been, I mean, because that episode is, like, so epic and, like, so long. I think it's the longest episode of the season, the finale, or the show, I think, the finale. I think it probably would have been nice if they had, like, sent an emissary or something and been like, look, we know you want a violence, but, like, last chance to not violence, and at least have that, like, olive branch extended.
I think it's worth, and this is a question I have actually about Amaya, but it's worth seeing the characters realize how far gone Viren is and how far he's willing to go. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like that part was kind of missing in the exchanges. Like, I had this question, like, when did Amaya figure out that Viren was a bad dude? Do we know that?
Well, she always hated him, I think. Okay. Like, they have that conversation in the first season in front of Sarai's monument, and, like, even then, like, he's being his, like, most charming self, and she, like, doesn't seem to be that convinced. Also the fact that she does freak out once. I feel like I'm, like, going into very granular details here, but, like, I did just rewatch it. She has that conversation when Janai comes to her and she's like, oh, your king is here, and, like, he's an asshole, and she's like, wait a second, no, that's not what's going on. So she's witnessed all that, to, like, the destruction of whatever it's called, Luxaria. So I think that's from her perspective, she is like, yeah, no, we have to take him down.
Yeah, I think I was just thrown by the part where she's like, he's the most dangerous human in the world. Like, I just didn't understand why she knew that at this point. But I guess he always has been to her. Not because dangerous can not just mean, like, fully evil, but also because she knows how powerful she is. I guess she would always know that. So,
yeah. And I guess from her perspective, he's, like, been the constant through, like, her sister dying, and then Hera dying, and then, like, the princess going missing and all that stuff. Should we pivot to Viren at this point?
Yes.
His standards are falling. He is accepting magical pink eye and then just adding to himself for half of the season. And I actually really like that, because it was, like, I think I enjoy the way they kind of pose Viren's descent as a descent, and that, like, he is being dragged to hell by Erebos, and in turn he is dragging Claudia with him, and, like, and they're both so persuasive that it's easy to be like, oh yeah, this, and then it comes out in the conversation he has with Harrow, like, this will be the last bad questionable thing we have to do, you know, just this one last thing, and then obviously, you know, it's not, but he's so convincing in that it continues to carry on this, like, this continual dragging to hell. And just watching this character who had been, like, so in control and so, like, composed for most of the time, like, really start to, like, look like he's losing it, even if he doesn't think that that's true. I thought that was effective. I mean, I prefer, like, competent on top of things Viren, as opposed to, like, bellowing about, like, the power Viren. But I think, yeah, it was a pretty good arc. And more in that, I'm interested to see where it goes from here. Because it's also just, like, Erebos keeps being like, oh, I can better serve you, and I'll serve you, and da-da-da. And it's like, no, dude, that's not what's going to happen. Like, come on.
Yeah, because he's like, I'm super evil, and I've been trapped for a long time. And he's never like, so what was that about?
Yeah, right.
But I guess, like, season one Viren, you kind of could be like, well, you know, maybe he's going to pull it back. Like, you know, he does seem kind of well-intentioned. Like, oh, no, wait, he did a couple really bad things. Like, he kind of wants to kill the kids, baby? What's going on here? Like, there are moments where you think, like, he's going to pull it back. But, like, it's, you know, this season, I think, is, you know, locks in that he's just kind of, you know, gone the whole way.
And I think you guys felt the same way. The moment where he really crosses the threshold into just being purely heinous is when he gaslights Soren in the prison cell and just makes him doubt that he ever was told to kill the princes. Like, that was just horrifically evil on a very personal level.
Yeah, I found that really uncomfortable to watch on a whole bunch of levels, but also just seeing Soren like so confused and not being equipped to really deal with it. Just like buying right into it because that's exactly what she wants to believe. Yeah, I found that like a really frustrating, like effective, but really frustrating scene to watch. You're a bad father, Mirren. You should feel bad.
Not the best guy.
No.
You're a mean one, Mr. Viren.
Seasonal.
So any thoughts on his relationship with, I don't even know what to call that bug. I mean...
His bug pal.
His bug pal.
Yeah.
Dang, that bug got big.
It really did.
It's getting bigger.
It's like, dude, you got worms, man. You need to get that treated.
And, like, it's so funny that, you know, I mean, obviously he's turned most of the army into sun-crazed, whatever, I don't even know what to call him at that point. But, like, you have that one counselor who was, you know, who orchestrated, like, the thing with Kasif and all that. And he's just, like, going along with it. It's like, dude, have you not noticed that there's, like, a huge bug hanging off his shoulder?
This tiny little earbug that no one saw. You're like, okay, now he's got like a snake wrapped around him and he looks like the devil. Yeah. He's created a bunch of monsters. Like, you have to, at some point, you have to be like, I'm going to go look for a stream to get some water and just ride back home. Like, just get out of here.
Yeah. And it's funny because it's like, on the one hand, like, I love Soren's arc and I love that he like rejects it. On the other hand, it's kind of like, well, yeah. he was the only one who was smart enough to do what everybody else should have done, and that's saying something. I will say I really liked the scene where they cross into Zadia, and it's very Moses splitting the Red Sea vibes, like extremely.
Yeah.
I like that a lot, like the perversion of that like thing into like invasion and fire and stuff like that. So let's talk about Soren and Claudia.
Mm.
Soren, my baby. He looks very good with the scruff, I have to say.
I could take or leave it.
Yeah, he goes from like hapless like idiot Jamie Lannister just following the bad commands to like, you know, I feel like maybe I was evil. I think I'll change.
I like that, but the bit where he's almost sort of working it out, like if someone just does evil stuff and wants to manipulate everyone, then they are the villain, and that is what I am now going to admit to myself. Yep. I thought it was kind of sweetly realistic, actually, as in sometimes there's a bit in Jojo Rabbit when at the end of the war, Jojo's best mate is like, it's not a good time to be Nazis. Maybe we weren't the good guys. And you think, yeah, that's like for normal dumbfuck people, like maybe that's kind of how it happens, you know. That movie is great.
I still need to see it. I love the way Soren, you know, kind of, I love that, you know, he and Claudia are such a contrast because she is all too willing to like forget, you know, everything that happened in the previous season. And she's just like, no, Soren misunderstood. He can walk now. So everything's fine. She like keeps doing the like, you're okay now. Everything's okay. And Soren has obviously been like much more deeply impacted, or he can't convince himself to forget about it. And I think that's a really interesting kind of contrast from like just the way their power works, right? Because Claudia's power works so much more like on the sidelines and sinisterly, and he's just like the big brute with the sword who can like attack you. So yeah, I enjoyed that a lot. And I think, I mean, he's just really funny. Like when he's just like climbing the mountain, he's like, oh, I shouldn't have done this in armor. I was like, yeah, that's actually a realistic joke that a lot of shows don't pay attention to. It's really hard to move in armor.
Looking at you there, Mando.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's Beskar. It's actually sure much lighter.
You can't ever take it off. Gosh.
It's the Valyrian steel of Star Wars.
Indeed. Yeah, I think I like this a lot, in part because I think this is one of the character things that they really did a good job setting up over a long period of time. Like, we've known since season one that Claudia is obviously more kind of attached and associated with Viren, and Soren has never really even really liked him. You know, he's been supportive of him, obviously, up to this point, but he's not, their relationship has not been good. So I like that they were both primed up to this point to make the choices they do. It all felt very natural, and like the thing that made sense with the decisions that have been made by Viren through this through this moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's funny, like I feel a little bad like defending Claudia, because obviously she has done like a lot of really bad things, and she like she does that spell at the end that is like really really powerful and damaging, and you know she tricks her brother into killing the fake version of their father, which I'm sure is hugely traumatic, even if it wasn't real. But like, I feel like I understand what motivates her, and that's why she's interesting to me, because like, she doesn't seem to be the type of person who's like power, power, power. She like really wants things to return to like the status quo, where she can trust her father, and like her father is good, and she can, you know, like make fun of her annoying brother, and like right. All these things are being like taken away from her. So she like is just fighting to get back to that status quo, and is like completely willing to do horrible things to get back to that. But it's not motivated by like a evil type thing, even though she does literally kill a guy at the end to
but it is motivated revive. Kind of by selfishness, right? Back to normal for her.
Yes.
Back to being daddy's sure. little girl who can trust and have faith in him. And that becomes of itself morally questionable. I find her to be by far the most fascinating character for all of these reasons, which I'm kind of semi-obsessed with. I think she's a very interesting character.
Yeah, I was speaking to the showrunners, and they pointed out that like Claudia
to the showrunners.
Well, anyway,
so famous.
Okay, Mikal, we love you for that.
But one of the things they noted is that Claudia is like, she's a dark, moving character, but she's not about power. She's about love. And like, I completely agree, Mina, like it is like an inherently selfish thing, but it's also like really understandable in its selfishness. Cause it's like I keep thinking like she keeps doing these like massive acts of dark magic that are like horrible. And then I'm like, well, if I was in the situation where like I knew I could do this thing that would restore my brother to health, or I knew I could do this thing that would bring my father back to life, like, would I not do that? Like, you know, it's a really complicated like question. And I think like I wish they like gave her more time to dwell on that, especially with, because she seems like very unimpressed by the Bugman. And like, even at the end, she's like kind of annoyed that like that's almost Viren's first thought when he revives. He's like, "Where's the thing?" She's like, "Oh, it's over there. It's growing."
Where's my bug lover?
Yeah. But there is actually a detail in the back of the scene. You can see like a prone pair of like feet, and like, yeah, so she definitely killed at least one person to do this spell.
Ugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, do you view her as a villain or not?
I don't. I know a lot of people do, and I think that's understandable, but I'm like, to a certain extent, it's like, well, what does it matter? If her motivations are what they are, like, it doesn't kind of matter if her actions are so bad. But I just don't think, like, I think to have a certain amount of villainy, you have to have a certain amount of awareness that, like, that this is like a really actively bad thing to do. And I genuinely don't think she has that. Like, I think that she goes the opposite direction from Soren, and she's like, he's like a bad person who does bad things and tries to make you do bad things as a villain. And she's like, no, she buys into the like, oh, this is the last time we'll have to do this, you know, and like it's all good, and like loyalty to my family is more important than the path we take to preserve that. And
we'll get back to zero and it'll be fine.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I think she's definitely like on a villain's path, but you know, in her mind, she's not just like, it's almost less like the good guy the bad guy who thinks they're the good guy. She's the quote unquote bad guy who doesn't think there's any moral stakes there at all, because she's not dealing on a grand moral plane. She's just dealing with like she, you know, the reason she says to Viren, like, in the finale is, like, the reason she's with him is, like, we're all that's left of our family, and I won't let anything happen to that. And that's, like, all that's motivating her. So, yeah, I agree. I find her, like, super interesting in, you know, especially because she's, like, a female character who is, like, sort of, like, the witchy. She has that witchy vibe to her, but she's not, like... Yeah, I don't know. I find her whole approach to things very, very interesting.
Yeah, that idea of her not quite getting the costs of her actions, like, I find it very believable. Like, I get that she, like, just doesn't think, like, killing the animals for the dark magic is a big deal. And even killing, like, if she did kill a person to do this, like, I think she just thinks, like, this is a soldier who pledged himself to die for her, his king. So this is part of that, you know, this is part of that cost. So I think, she just doesn't, like, quite get that these are costs, that they are things that are being lost. Like, these are just part of what she has to do. So I find that really fascinating too. And I'm really curious.
Yeah, I mean,
to
it's literally the slippery slope, because she keeps selling herself this stuff from the beginning. And when confronted with the aspects of dark magic, they're like, you know, we really shouldn't be doing this. But then it's like, then that means her dad's evil. That means she's evil. So she can't accept it. So she just has to keep buying into the next thing, whatever it is, which is unfortunate. But she's very likable is the thing. And up until, I mean, you know, the whole, like, necromancy and all that, like, really it feels like she's not actively, like, part of the evil, you know. She's just sort of like, well, I mean, this is, it's all gonna work out in the end, it'll be fine, because she's in such denial. But, like, she hasn't really bought in. I'm like, well, I just want to, you know, I need to kill all these creatures, right, or whatever it is, you know. Yeah, it's kind of sad.
Yeah, she's definitely my favorite. And I think part of my, like, a little bit, like, dissatisfaction with the season was that she had such a small part, whereas last season she had that really interesting arc with her and Soren. But hopefully there'll be more and we can get more into her. I think those are the major characters. What did you get? We got a lot more about the Sunfire Elves and their kind of their culture, and Amaya and Janai. Which I actually really enjoyed. I love the interpreter. Like, she, or they, I think they're referring to them as they pronouns, is, like, the cutest possible thing, and I love them so much. What'd you guys think of that plotline?
I really liked the world building and getting to know more about how the mechanics of it.
Mm-hmm. And, like, the whole idea of, like, the light will decide. I'm like, you know, you think that... you know, it's funny because there is kind of like a Tolkien-esque thing a little bit with, you know, even the first scene of the season, which I really enjoyed, with Sol Ragam and the first Dark Mage, who we assume is the first Dark Mage. You know, he's like, you want humans to go back to being lesser beings, and Sol Ragam is like, you are lesser beings. And it seems like a lot of the, you know, like the queen of the Sunfire Elves seems to still believe that, and she doesn't have a problem, like, arguing with that philosophy. Yeah. And that, like, guides a lot of her actions, which makes it really powerful that Janai is kind of able to, like, see around that. Did anyone else love the interpreter, or is it just me?
Oh, she was amazing. She was just so funny and quirky and cool.
Yeah. And I always like when, like, a military society also has room for, like, nerds, you know, because I'm like, oh, okay, that's where I would be.
That's my job.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I guess we should talk about the flashback.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I found the imagery,
the murder of Sunder.
Yeah. It was so complicated, and, like, obviously, like, again, that kind of sense of being dragged down to hell, like, you're doing the wrong thing, and Harrow knows that he's doing the wrong thing, but, like, he keeps getting argued into it, and, like convinced that, like, again, this is the last thing we'll have to do. It's not, you know, like, yes, this is bad, but it'll end all the other bad things. And I found the culmination of that, like, the scene where Thunder is turned into stone is, like incredibly visually moving, and, like actually really upsetting to watch.
But I sort of get the idea of, like, well, we got to take this king dragon out. The timeline, I don't really understand exactly how long things have been separated, but yeah, clearly the humans were second class citizens, and just, like, the way that so many people, like, you know, like, you know, in the flashback with that other dark mage where Sol Ragam's just like, well, I'm just going to destroy a whole town if you don't do what I want, or, you know, a whole giant city or whatever that was. I don't know, like they're dangerous and destructive and kind of they have bigoted attitudes. So like for King Harrow, I sort of get him being like, well, you know, he murdered my wife. Like, okay, like I'm sort of on board with that, even though not really a great idea overall, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very compelling argument, right? Because, like, you know, I find Ezrin's argument about how, like, you know, we can choose to end hostilities right here and now, and, like, that will be the end of it, and that is the choice that we are going to make to not continue this and to not take vengeance. Like, that's really, really powerful. At the same time, if you're in a position where, like, the other side, whatever they are going to press that advantage by you not responding, then it's like, well, what do you do? Like, which way do you go? Is peace actually the active, or is non-response the right choice? And, like, I think that it's complicated because it doesn't seem like Thunder Avazandum was attacking the human kingdoms, you know? Like, he definitely posed a threat in his existence, but he wasn't pursuing that. Like, he definitely didn't seem to be, like, conquering human kingdoms or anything like that. So they are the ones who are coming into his territory and being like, we're starting this up again. And then argument for killing Zim, or the egg at that point, is like, his name will be vengeance. Like, we've done this thing, so we have to stop this kid from doing the thing that we did to us. And, you know, it's just such a snarl of ideas. And then when you have, like, in the present, you know, Ezrin and Callum and Rayla and Zim, like, all in that valley, like, with it, this huge stone dragon. Like, I found that contrast really, really effective and powerful.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything you can justify the actions of Viren and Hera with beyond just it's just vengeance. Like, that he loved his wife so much that he sees this as just the natural justification for her death, and he will inflict that same pain back. Like, I feel like that's it, and that's just a human thing. Like, there's no, like, I don't think it's like we're gonna prevent him from attacking us, we're gonna keep our kingdom safe. I think it's purely, I want to kill this guy because of what he did to my wife.
Yeah, well, the spell is very clear on that. Like, he's like, what we need is the hate of the person who loved the victim. Yeah. And it's like, yep, you got that.
Which I think, I don't think we've seen Harrow quite presented that way before. And I liked having that aspect of him. Mm-hmm. And how I think it actually changes him afterward. I think he self-reflects after this moment pretty significantly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think he's, like, haunted by that. Because it's hard to explain his actions in the first season in terms of, like, really being willing to accept the consequences. You know, without that transformation. And I think that's also very, I mean, you know, Ezrin doesn't get it from nowhere, you know, like, he gets the self-reflection, I think, from his father. There's one other thing. Oh, I love the line where Callum is, like, talking about, you know, how upset it makes him to, like, see the dragon that his father killed, his stepfather killed, because his mother was killed by the dragon, and that dragon being Zim's father, and, like, Ezrin and Zim, like, playing in this valley. And he was like, how am I supposed to feel about this? And Rayla says, I don't know. And I was like, that is, I feel like, a really subtle, like, an accurate way of talking about this, because, like, there's not always, like, a right feeling, you know, in events that are this complicated.
No, yeah, I mean, think about it, right? Like, my father killed his father killed my mother. Like, how do you feel about this? You know, it's really complicated, and I'm glad they addressed that.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on the
Not his father, by the way. They're not related.
Yeah. Cool. Is there anything I'm forgetting?
Maybe expectations for the next season?
Well, first we have to hope that there will be a next season.
Do you think that's in doubt, though? Or is that...
It is in doubt, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Gosh.
They haven't been picked up yet. You know, it's a very popular show, so hopefully. But we'll see. Yeah, I mean, I think... somebody, was it Adam in the chat, who was talking about Claudia being kind of more attractive of a dark magic partner to whatever comes out of that cocoon. than Viren. Because I agree. I think that might actually be part of her journey, that like it comes to like, you know, Viren is used up and rejected and not, you know,
yeah,
not
need. That'd be sad.
Yeah.
And there's a pretty clear hint of something that like that with Erebos, where he looks at Claudia and says like she's useful or something like that. So, yeah.
I kind of wonder where Soren's going to go from here. Like, is he going to have any, like, is he going to have a confrontation with Claudia and his father? Like, you know, because that confrontation that did happen was sort of, like, not really real on, obviously it wasn't at all real from Viren's perspective, but it wasn't either really real from Claudia's perspective because she was using it to buy time.
Can we talk about how, yeah, she, like, gets him to kill the fake Viren, and she's just, like, the most disappointed. Like, not, it felt like she was disappointed because, like, oh, how would you kill our father? But also just sort of, like, oh, like, you know, I didn't think you could do that. Like, well, okay. Like, it wasn't even necessarily, like, you know, you've killed our father, and, you know, it's like, he's a rampaging, like monster. She just seems sort of like disappointed that like her plan was exposed a little sooner than she wanted it to be.
I will say I didn't love kind of like the first last ending, the first ending of the season, which is like the dragon. I mean, I'm totally fine with it being like the dragon queen wakes up and like everything's great and calm and, you know, and peace and whatever. But like, I feel like she didn't have to put that into words quite as explicitly. She's like, basically like, everything's wonderful now. And I was like, I could use a little more nuance in this situation.
So were we meant to sort of think that the woken up dragon mum is going to be equal in power or capable of being bested by the suddenly magically quite large snake thing? Otherwise, having the dragon mum wake up, isn't that like a massive imbalance of power?
Well, I think, I mean, it seems like her, like Avizandum was the one who imprisoned Erebos in the first place. So it does seem like there's a lot of like back and forth in terms of the, like, obviously he was a big enough threat to be imprisoned that thoroughly. And I assume he's coming back in like a physical form where he's able to do a lot more bad magic stuff.
Okay. So he's like, kind of like Voldemort. He's going to sort of assemble and...
Yeah. I think he's like, he's leveling up. He's coming into his, you know, as much of his true form as he can in this physical world. I don't know how the bug didn't get completely smashed when it fell from that very tall height, but that's okay. It's a magic bug. So I mean that's my theory about what's coming next from Erebos. This is like he's definitely breaking out and you know, this is like not to be like, oh, this is all a part of my plan, but I do think there's a certain degree to which this is all a part of his plan.
Okay, understood. Yeah. So that will be the big fight. For the final, well, next
well, the next final season. The next segment of the show, I don't know if it's in terms of like actually changing the title of the show, but they've said at like Comic-Con and stuff that they envision this, like the first three seasons as like the Dragon Prince, and then the next two, I think, as the Mystery of Erebos.
Oh.
And like, yeah, so I think he's gonna definitely take center stage. Because even at the very beginning of the season, the Dark Mage says like he doesn't want to put down the staff because it was a gift, right? And then Solragam like freaks out and he's like, "Who gave it to you?" And he doesn't say. And my assumption was like that was definitely Erebos.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the only way for the show to go, really. Like, I think that's the only thing that makes sense, because, like, I feel like for us to understand, obviously, this long-running conflict between the human kingdoms and the elves, like, we need to understand what Erebos was doing. Like, that's essential to the thesis of the show, I think, is to getting that, so that the conflicts we have now and the views on both sides feel, like, fully fleshed out is, like, seeing where that all came from. So I'm happy that that's where they're thinking of going.
Mm-hmm. And it does kind of unite all of the threads, you know, and like it takes the current characters and enables them to interact with like the primal, you know, to use that word, origins of the story. Do we think Rayla's parents are in the coins?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, I hope so.
It's like Jay-Z being in the doorknob in Twin Peaks.
Oh God, I'm so glad I don't watch Twin Peaks. It sounds so creepy.
It is creepy.
That's just the beginning.
I know. Yeah, Katie's told me a lot about that. I'm just like, oh my God. But I found the whole like Athari seen, you know, as I said, just like super powerful. And then when you have like that image of like his, you know, Renan's flower, like floating in between life and death. And obviously we know where he is, like, that was just like very effective to me. And that seemed to be like they were very much like, no, this is not over. Like we're I don't know if they're going to have like a journey into Coinland or something, but like there definitely seems to be something very significant in that.
Do you feel like it maybe, I don't necessarily feel this way, I'm just curious, it maybe kind of undercuts the arcs of people like Rayla or Athari if those people just come back? Is that like an easy solution to the things they had to go through, or I don't know.
I don't personally, because it's like a protracted length of time and those things have already had major consequences. Like all of Rayla's motivations are, you know, because my parents abandoned their post, you know, and Athari like is willing to do that spell on somebody he considered a daughter because of that.
Elves don't really look into shit too much.
No.
Maybe check under the water. Maybe look in there, get a scuba. Take a look.
Yeah, seriously, like, damn, man. Like, you know, I mean, then you got like the sky elf trying to steal the egg, and like, I don't know. They got some pretty despicable people on their side.
Yeah. I didn't love the Nyx stuff. She was kind of like, I mean, she was a little better the second time I watched it, but like the first time I was just like, okay, like why are we like, I get it, you have to kiss or whatever, but like do we need like two episodes basically devoted to setting this up, and then like she steals them but they're still traveling with her? Like I it didn't super work for me.
I'm just gonna need the end of this podcast to have someone saying, anyway, here's the Wonderwall. That's gonna be essential.
Oh yeah, and for Avatar fans, there were a lot of
references. Oh my god, the boomerang thing was so
By the way, Bina, I know you are like beyond swamped in material, but like I actually really think you would love Avatar The Last Airbender.
Really?
If you like The Dragon Prince, you really will. Yeah, you really will like it. Yeah.
You're not the first person to say, so maybe I should check it out.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
It really is.
So there was that, and then there was also the Sailor Moon transformation, which
a couple of them. We had Lu Xun do it and Kel. Yeah. And there's an Indiana Jones reference as well.
right. Why did it have to be this whole thing?
Yeah.
A lot of them are around Nyx for some reason. I wonder why.
Maybe because she's like just a side character that's not that important.
Exactly. We're not really sure why we're here. We just need to fill this out. Yeah. Am I forgetting anything? I feel like, let me look back at my little listy thing that I made.
Just going to give a shout out to Jelly Tart Guy fighting with his jelly tarts.
And yes!
That would be the kind of king I would be. Can I have all the jelly tarts? Those would be the sort of perks I would be into, yeah. I mean, I feel like it's okay just to have an hour's worth of material because it is basically only 4.5 hours of TV.
Yeah, that's true. Just to point out a couple of extra things that I thought were powerful. When Janai's sister is killed by Viren, and she's like running, like trying to run back to, you know, take her vengeance, and Amaya like puts her hand on top of Janai's like literally burning hand. Like I found that a really powerful visual to stop her. The scene where Zim is trying to wake up his mom and like the music is like, it might work, and I'm like, it's not gonna work, and then it doesn't work and he just curls up in like the little hole where his egg was, like that made me very sad. Case of Death was shockingly violent. Like there were definitely arrows like I am like his body, and I wasn't expecting to see that. Gren cries when he and Amaya reunite at the end, which I thought was very nice to see.
Love a Gren.
And then I love Gren. Yeah, not enough Gren content in this season for sure. And then Bait defends Zim in front of Viren. Yeah,
that was very cute. That was really lovely.
Oh man, so many good Bait moments. Like Bait freaking out when they realize about Rayla and Callum. His face, so good. And also when Rayla's trapped and like Bait saves her.
Mm-hmm.
Like the face there is just so good.
The funny thing in this scene where he and Ezrin find out about Callum and Rayla is that If you watch it carefully, Bait's jaw drops
first,
like a good second before you
realize it's dark. Quick on the uptake, Bait.
Yeah.
I did like the moment. It's kind of cliche, but I did like it, especially because it's been set up from the first episode when the Sun Elf helps up the guy from the first episode who Rayla saved. He says his name, I can't remember, but
Marcos.
That was nice. I just appreciated the symbolism of that.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I wonder if they're going to, like, go back to the fire zombies or whatever, the fire wipe, if they're going to, like, figure out how to reverse that, or if it's just going to be, like, a shove to the side type of thing. I kind of hope they deal with it, but they might not. Okay, so I think that is going to do it for us in this episode of Vassals of Kingsgrave Talks the Dragon Prince. And thank you, everyone, for joining and for conversation. And hopefully we'll be able to talk about this more soon. I know that there are more books coming out. They're, like, kind of doing some things with Galactic, some narrative, some, like, more kid-focused books.
They've done books based off the show sort of deal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, novelizations, but, like, at least they are trying to make them... At least, you know, I don't know if it'll really happen, right? But they said, like, we're trying not to make them, like, you know, just, like, cheap novelizations. No offense to anyone who writes those, because you got to do what you got to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So thank you so much for joining us. And we may have some adorable words from our own Dr. Blood and baby Dr. Blood coming at the end. So
that will very much be the highlight of the episode.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty easy, yeah, to say that.
Like, accused of, like, misogynistic, manipulative, bad boss behavior. And I know, it's very disappointing, but it's also, like... The people who are accusing him of this, who I'm sure feel very justified in a lot of pain and whatever, are sort of acting like it's like a Me Too level thing. And they're like, why aren't people reporting on this? And it's like, well, it kind of feels like an internal work thing, doesn't it? So.
It's always confusing when a person's... Sorry, can you hear monkish music?
No, you're good.
Okay, that's just weird.
Hello.
I kind of want to, though.
I'm having a nostalgia day. I'm playing the really old medieval Total War game.
Oh.
From like 20 years ago.
Love it.
It's always confusing when someone's art has values within it that don't match up with their apparent real life. This dissonance I find very confusing. You know, there are some artists that are problematic, such as Wagner, and for some people, Woody Allen, where you can see echoes of the problems in the art. But with Dragon Prince, it's so progressive and wholesome, it feels bizarre that you would have misogyny in the personal life that isn't reflected in the art.
Could be disingenuous.
Oh, is there like a controversy?
Yeah.
I think for me, like, my feeling, and again, I don't fully have the situation for this one, but, like, I just think, like, everyone hates their boss. Like, that's what I come from with, like, this kind of stuff, is, like, most people don't like their boss, so I, like, moderate these kind of things with that, so.
Someone who works for me this week, when we were in Oxford, bought me a pair of Tolkien earrings. We're in the Bodleian Bookshop. And they had all this Tolkien merchandise. And this lovely woman who works for me in Hong Kong just at the end presented me with this pair of Tolkien earrings. So that was very tough.
So not everyone hates their boss.
Maybe some bosses are more awesome than others.
No.
Far of it for me to say. Although I just
there are a lot of bad bosses for lots of different reasons. So
yeah.
It's a thing.
Oh, dear.
So Peter Principle.
I'm glad this happened. It was really fun to watch this, and I'm glad to hear all your thoughts on it.
Yeah, me too. It's nice that, like, I mean, I know a lot of people watch the show, but, like, whenever you're watching something that's aimed at kids, like, I feel like I need constant, like, validation that, like, no, it's actually good, and I'm not just being, like, you know, somebody who likes children's material, which is fine, but, you know.
I mean, ultimately, I've been thinking about this a lot with The Mandalorian. That is, a lot of that is just in its format aimed at kids, too, and that's okay.
Yeah, it's true. So, I mean, simple storytelling is effective. It just, it is.
I don't know when we got embarrassed about that.
Good point.
Yeah, the Mandalorian is like the ultimate Disney creation. Like they created it in a lab to appeal to everyone.
Yeah, it's like when you go in and they say, they give you like a dropper of a clear liquid and you're like, what is this? And you're like, oh, it's a French fry. Oh, it's a burger. You're like, well, you know.
The tragedy of the Mandalorian, and I guess we'll get into this when we discuss the Mandalorian in Avok, is that...
Oh, we need to.
It's so good that you feel that if you could do this, if you were capable of this... Why are the films not as good? And it's kind of, I mean, I guess we watched this in the shadow of Rise of Skywalker and much will be known after that. But yeah, it just kind of frustrates. I simultaneously both adore it and it frustrates me.
Yeah, I hear that. I mean, I think
part
of my thesis, and I guess I can get into this, you know, on the Mandalorian cast, but like the Mandalorian is so simple and Star Wars movies have gotten quite complicated. And like A New Hope is not a complicated movie at all. It's like really paint by numbers, very simple. And yet, obviously, everybody loves it. And I think The Mandalorian is kind of drawing from that, like, you know, we don't need to worry about all the details. We don't need to worry about how things work necessarily. Like, just kind of focus on, like, the, not even necessarily the in-story emotions, but, like, how you feel watching it.
Mm.
And that's my personal theory for now.
No need to overcomplicate.
Yeah, I
think the problem with the... Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I hope Rise of Skywalker kind of like knocks it out of the park and brings things back, but I feel like it needs to be like 5 hours to do that, so I don't know what's gonna happen in this stupid movie.
Feeling is like, I think the problem with the sequel movies has been that they're just too conscious of the fact that they are a Star Wars movie, and they're trying to, like in the case of The Force Awakens, it was obviously like trying to be a lot like a past Star Wars movie so that people would enjoy it, again conscious of the prequels of being something else that people didn't like, so they were like, let's go back to the well and do the thing we know people liked, and people didn't like it for that reason. And then The Last Jedi came along.
I liked it.
No, I like
them
both.
A lot of people still did.
To be clear, I like both movies a lot, so moderating that with what I'm saying here, I'm just like gauging the general audience reaction. But so with The Last Jedi comes along and Rian Johnson's like, all right, we need to not be so derivative here. We need to do something entirely different. We need to subvert people's expectations.
I'm going to give you not Star Wars.
So I'm going to do this thing. And it's cool in some ways, but in some ways it felt like it wasn't, of course, like a continuous story, which is important for the trilogy, but also it felt like it was not Star Wars. And I think it is just that Star Wars is a simple story. It's like a very mythic story. It's like, it's okay if it repeats and goes again and again and it does these things like trying to like it, like the consciousness of being Star Wars and the consciousness of trying to like do something new and interesting or just to do something that fits, like it just like that's kind of like, and not just focusing on like, I'm going to tell this story, I think is what affected both those movies in a negative way.
But I mean, look at Rogue One and even to a lesser degree Solo. I mean, I think they did a good job.
It would be very interesting to me to see how Rogue One and Solo kind of like age. I think Rogue One has people have like generally liked it more.
I loved it then and love it now. Solo, yeah. I think, was pleasantly surprising, just maybe because it came
right
on the backs
no
of Last Jedi. And what worries me about this new one is it depends how J.J. Abrams approaches it. If he thinks he has to unwind some of the stuff that was done in Last Jedi, like there's only one movie, he's got to tell his story. If he gets too hung up on sort of trying to unwind some of that stuff,
it's going to look really bad in totality. It's going to look like a tug of war.
I think it is, right? And that's what I sensed in the last one. And I think that's the tragedy of not having the same person direct all of them, I think.
Well, it was kind of baffling how like they just didn't. Like, you know, I assumed with the story group that, like, there was definitely a general arc. And then, like, Rian Johnson keeps saying, like, nope, they were like, hey, do whatever you want. And I'm like, but that's, like...
Why have a story group?
Well, I mean, like, Kathleen Kennedy, like, they said that was, like, JJ came in and I think they tried to get him to do, like, the trilogy. And he's like, I'm just going to want to done this. And they're like, okay, we'll bring in new voices. But there needed to be a very clear, like, A, B, C. You need to get to B, and these two things need to happen and create your story around that. But instead, you're right. They just came in and were like, here's the next one. Figure it out. which is less than ideal. Like, you needed someone shepherding that, saying, hey, no, you kind of, this is the direction we're going, this is where we're ending up. So
I think with The Last Jedi also, like, I mean, part of the reason I don't like it is not fair and not the movie's fault. It's just, like, so many of the Resistance die. Like, I don't like watching Resistance members die or Rebellion members die. Like, I leave the room whenever we're watching A New Hope and, like, they're fighting the Death Star, because I'm like, I just don't need to see this.
Porkins for some reason. Down.
Yeah. It really impacts me for some reason, which is also why I didn't love Rogue one of the reasons. But like, that's me, that's not like the movie's fault, this is part of Star Wars. But like, it's almost like pick like two or three or one or two things to like majorly overhaul, you know, and then like maybe the rest we don't go as crazy on. But he just hits like every single thing that you're expecting, and like I think some of it works, you know. But like I don't hate The Last Jedi, I'm more still just a little bit like baffled by it.
Because there's just so much pointlessness, and, you know, like, again, like, just with all the Resistance members dying, like, there were plenty of times when they could have apparently gotten away. You could have sent a lot of them away in, you know, ships or lifeboats or something. And that just the whole setup in the movie is what I always hated. The rest of the movie wasn't so bad, but
I think a big problem with it is actually a problem in The Force Awakens, that they just never figured out what to do with. Is like, the stakes and all this, like, are really unclear. Like, what is the Republic and what is the First Order, and like, what are they fighting for? like in the original trilogy, like, it was so clear, like, the rebels were obviously trying to fight against this empire that felt powerful and overwhelming, but it's like they're both splinter groups fighting in the middle of nowhere. Like,
yeah, in The Force Awakens, they wanted to have the Empire back, but not. So they wanted to have this giant, like, you know, intimidating military force, except a lot of people deny they even exist. You're like, wait, how does that work? And then in Last Jedi, it's like they flipped a switch and like, well, they've taken over half the galaxy in a day. And you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, just like the world building from the start was really, really off. And it's funny because, like, they're in just like a couple lines in The Mandalorian, they've done a better job with it. Like, just like Mando saying, like, that's a joke when Greef Karga is saying how he should go to the Republic and report the Imperial Remnant people that want to be right. Yoda. But like, just like saying that one line is like, okay, so the Republic's kind of a mess right now. It's not something people trust. Like, doing stuff like that and setting up like the forces against them, like Werner Herzog and all those people, like that's so much more interesting than like, we're
like,
this
the
giant
were still person valuable, like,
doing stuff, we're gonna blow up all the planets. It's just like,
we have a planet that's really a Death Star. Gosh.
The thing is, like, I keep coming back to, like, one of the things I love about The Mandalorian, and, like, I don't know if everybody's seen the latest episode. I didn't love the latest episode.
I don't like Amy Sedaris with a
alien. No, she was great.
And Ming-Na Wen.
She was great. Killed immediately, and everybody's drinking stupid juice in the episode, particularly The Mandalorian. But like, for the most part, I think The Mandalorian show is like really, really good with economical A, storytelling, and B, like, parceling out of information. So, like, we basically learn what we need to know when we need to know it, which to me is, like, epitomized in Star Wars when, like, you know, Obi-Wan is like, oh, your dad and I fought in the Clone Wars. And it's like, what's the Clone Wars? Yeah. Don't need to know. We're not going to talk about it.
That.
Yeah.
Unless you go make prequels about it.
Right.
Yeah, it's where, like, we all had to fight our clones to the death to decide the galaxy.
I mean, I still think that, you know, I know people love the Clone Wars, like, TV series, and, like, that's cool. I've never seen it, so maybe it's amazing. But, like, to me, just saying the Clone Wars is so much more cool than any story you could possibly tell about it, that, like, I think it's kind of defeating the purpose and not understanding why that kind of reference works and builds the world.
You are both right, and the show has also, like, had a ton of really great episodes that were good, but it is one of those things where, like, we don't need to know. Like, a lot of times narrative fails when you try to explain the things that don't need to be explained, when you try to be like, okay, we got to give every inch of the backstory, which is something where it's like, you have, like, someone like Damon Lindelof with, like, Lost, and, like, you know, he got a lot of shit because, you know, he just didn't, like, pay off so many things, where, you know, it's sort of like the opposite of that. where it's like, it's cool to not know things, but then you need to know some things. It's like this weird balance that can be really hard to hit.
That's a good point. There are, it's a tricky thing, right? Like, there's some things that you do need to pay off.
But there's a difference between paying off and paying off things that the audience does need to know, and then there's telling the audience things because it's Star Wars and we need to have a novel about every, you know, minor character.
That's my favorite Star Wars thing, is like always like one character becomes like a whole race or like a whole thing. Like every individual character in the frame in the original trilogy like becomes a thing. It's so weird.
Yeah.
You could argue they've done with Baby Yoda, right? I mean, that was like the one thing that we didn't know about. And now we're going to know about
the Yoda race and all that. Yeah.
I'm okay with that. Well, because Baby Yoda is so
Baby Yoda,
my life
best.
Is better because he's in it. But also because like Yoda is such a huge part of the story that like to me it's like kind of fair to investigate that further. I mean, we'll see if it, you know, plays out satisfactorily. But like Star Wars is always working against my philosophy of storytelling, which is that like not to like give you guys a whole lecture on my philosophy of storytelling, but like stories to me are lace, and what you don't see is equally as powerful as what you do see. It just has to be placed right, and like it Star Wars is terrible at that, and like especially with like the novels and whatever, and whenever the, you know, the TV shows or the movies start going down the path of the novels where things get too complicated and the details really matter and we have to tell you exactly where this thing came from and why, like that to me is like Star Wars disaster.
You know who's amazing at that is Tolkien, by the way, in Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
That's what I was just thinking.
It's funny
because
he tells you
really
everything
well
in the end, but like he doesn't leave a lot of things blank, but at the same
time. No, he does. And even with, especially in Lord of the Rings. I mean, in Silmarillion, he tries to, that is a lot of filling in the gaps, but the way
but
he
I mean, you don't
poetry
need it
in
to like enjoy Lord of the Rings. I mean, like the fans of the series that have never read the Silmarillion or never gone to any of the ancillary material, they've gotten a lot out of it. But then, like the people that dig into it, I feel like get more. But you know, that's because it's their thing. You know, so I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my rant about stories.
That'll make a good after-show.
Yeah, Baby Yoda, highly problematic. Any species that lives for 50 years and is still basically an infant does not exist. I'm just saying, like, how does that even? How does
I
that
assume
even
like Baby Yoda was like a tadpole or something. I don't know. Like, it was a slow period of becoming this.
Like, yeah, just evolutionary, just too risky. I just assumed because like Baby Yoda is like 1,000 years old. I assume that like, you know, they take a while to like mature, but like not that long.
But they're literally like there are battles with sound in space.
Yeah, but that's, you know, I got to hear the pew pew pew. I mean, you know, if I don't hear that, then what's the point?
Yeah,
I mean, yeah,
I agree.
I love the pew.
Okay, well, this seems like a sensible place to end it with a bit of a brat brat pew pew.
Yeah, always.
Seriously, how you guard people walking back and forth?